Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. A growing number of America's wealthiest citizens are devoting significant sums to philanthropy. Their purpose is to advance the social good, but can they make up for some of the inequities that allowed them to amass that fortune to begin with? This is among the questions raised by Anand Giridharadas. He's the author of the new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcos Kunalakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
I'm happy to be here with Anand Giridharadas, and my name is Marcos Kunalakis, and together we have many syllables. You know, it's really a pleasure to have you here and to discuss your evocative title, Winners Take All. It is not a question mark. It is a statement. There should be an exclamation point. He is suggesting that winners do, in fact, take all. You talk about elites, and you talk about their desire to do good, and you often within the book talk about this concept of win-win. As I was reading parts of the book, it reminded me a little bit of, and I'll take a little bit of a stretch here, it reminded me a bit of how tobacco companies function, so that tobacco companies tend to do a lot of bad in the world. They tend to give us cancer, create health problems of all sorts, but they're the companies that expend the most on anti-smoking campaigns.
That's sadly a very smart way to think about it. It may be a slightly more extreme form than some of the cases we're thinking about. But to step back, I came to the subject of this book because of an observation of a paradox that fits very much in the terms of that tobacco example, but extends very much to our whole society. And the paradox is the following. On one hand, it is hard to walk down the street without bumping into a plutocrat trying to change the world. Okay.
There are probably some in this room.
There are probably some in this room, and you know, we hope you give generously. You know, we have a new person announcing a multi-billion-dollar gift every couple days in the newspaper, right? Many of them in this city. We now have in San Francisco a contest between billionaires about whose approach to homelessness is more generous.
That's right.
We have 184 super rich people having signed the giving pledge to give most of their assets away in their lifetimes. When you go shopping in the mall, you know, it's hard to avoid all these products that promise to change the world. An iPhone case is going to change the world, and Bono is involved somehow. Tote bags are going to change the world, socks that are going to change the world.
Yes.
When I go to college campuses, you find young people who are, it's hard to not find young people who are determined to start a social enterprise involving Rwanda, recycled poop, you know, coffee, and like give one, get one, you know. Tom's shoes is somehow connected. And that generosity on the part of elites, whether they're billionaires or just young people with great educations, sits uneasily next to another set of facts with which you're all also familiar, which is the fact that this is the most unequal time in 100 years in this country and getting worse. That last year, the wages of the top 1% grew four times faster than the bottom 90%. The fact that last year, 82% of all new wealth created in the world went to that top 1% in the world. The fact that the bottom half of Americans have not gotten a raise on average since 1979. And so what you have, the paradox, is real and manifest elite generosity in our age, real helping, sitting uncomfortably alongside elite hoarding. And the very people, in many cases, doing the helping, as in your example, doing the generosity, starting a disruptive tech company that's going to emancipate mankind, writing huge checks, you know, taking care of the homeless, those same people are the people harvesting most of the rainwater of progress and grabbing it for themselves and claiming to be making the world better. And so I became interested in the relationship between that elite helping and that elite hoarding, between the giving and the taking. And I'm a reporter, so I opine at the end of reporting. And I went and reported.
Yes.
Did what I did. And I spent time in this world. I spent time with entrepreneurs and philanthropists and young people trying to figure out what to do with their lives and many others. And my conclusion at the end of that journey of reporting of a couple of years was that when elites step into the arena of social change, they don't sit in the back row. They sit in the front row. They get on the board of directors of Change Inc. They take over change. And when they take over change, they change change. They redefine change in winner-friendly ways. So on any issue you could pick, say empowering women, there's kind of real change, and we know what that would look like. Mm-hmm. Family policy that would actually be helpful.
Women on the boards of organizations, et cetera.
You know, harassment laws, so yes. Getting groped at the office is not an everyday reality for people. Maternity leave, just to do something that every other rich country does. But those things are all expensive for winners and men and people with power. So what the winners of our age do is they don't say, nope, women, you can't get empowered, because that wouldn't work. So what they say is, that's all great, but you know, I got another idea. So it's more of a win-win. We will tell you to lean in, and then you lean in, and things will be great. Now, never mind that they have just turned discrimination against women into a problem that women are supposed to solve in their private time. But that kind of jiu-jitsu, where a social problem that can frankly only be solved through real change, real reform, laws, movements, policy, is turned into a winner-friendly thing, where change can happen without changing who has power, without disturbing the status quo, without costing the people on top anything. And I think you can take education and do a similar analysis of real change would mean equal public schools for everybody, not Marin having better schools than, you know, South San Francisco. But then you can have fake change, which is like, let's do one charter school for 300 kids, and I'll tell my friends that I helped those three minority kids get into Yale, and it'll be great. And I think you can, on any example in American life, you can think of where we are hearing real change and pushes for real change and where we're hearing this fake change. And my argument, in a nutshell, is that fake change is what you get when you put the people most to lose from real change in charge of change.
Well, you know, your statistics were fascinating. In fact, you noted we're in San Francisco today. We're recording this in California. And in fact, California is, in a global sense, the fifth largest economy in the world. And yet, as probably everyone in this room knows, about a quarter of our population is living below the poverty line. So that reality is something that we're confronting on a daily basis, and that change, in fact, would be able to take care of that part of our population, and that we're not seeing necessarily the types of abilities, either at the state level or within private right. industry, to be able to make the type of change that you are highlighting, and which, of course, we should all be concerned about on a daily basis. But are there places, and you alluded to this, are there places that are not necessarily system preservation structures around the world that do this better? I think we're talking about family policies that exist in these wealthier nations, other developed nations around the world. Let's touch on that a bit, and then we'll return to the sort of system preservation idea that you're talking about, and that you've written about quite eloquently.
Well, first of all, just to pick up on your San Francisco point, the numbers are important. There are about 7,499 homeless people in San Francisco by the last count, and coincidentally, 74 billionaires. It's about 101 billionaires, 101 homeless people per billionaire. 74 billionaires in this city, if this city, not just the city, the five counties around it, if this area were a country, five counties,
yeah.
It'd be the ninth ranking country on earth for billionaire population. The idea that that such a problem could persist in a city with 74 billionaires that takes, you know, 15 minutes to drive across at the right hour of the day is just astonishing. And so when it comes to places that are doing it right, I mean, people often come to me and say, you know, well, this is what you're pushing is very, it's very out there. It's very radical. Well, I'm sort of pushing for the end of a dismal exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. The reality, most of the things I'm talking about are basically solved across the rich world, except for here. Mm-hmm. We don't know that because we think the world is here.
Yes.
And the flags, you know, fulfill that illusion. But the reality is, I'm talking about things that are pretty basic. Like, you know, on our political ads, you know this well.
I do.
In so many of our political ads, right? What's the like, iconic trope? It's like an American family in a house that's, like, not too nice, but not too not nice. And they're sitting around a table holding medical bills, right? How many ads like that have you seen? Like, 1,000 ads like that, right? Do you realize that in many rich countries, there are no such scenes because there are no such bills?
Right.
And people are actually asking their kid how their day was,
yes,
or doing art with their kid, or thinking about the company they're going to start, and they're actually not spending time thinking about whether their insurance company dropped them. Do you know, like, I'm a very privileged person. I spend an enormous amount of time, and my wife, worrying about, we're on Obamacare, we're on, like, a great plan, but they, like, dropped our daughter because she didn't have a Social Security number, which she didn't have because she hadn't been born yet. And then it's 2 months to get her back, and you just don't want to get her sick when she's in the first 2 months of her life. And you just think, like, I can navigate this. I have the education, skills, and time to navigate this. We are keeping millions of people in this, like, weird limbo that is just dumb. In addition to being cruel, it's dumb. And that's just one example of something that literally does not exist across the rich world. And I could tell the same story in education. I'm not sure there's any other rich country that decided that the best way to fund public education is by ring-fencing property taxes in rich neighborhoods, creating really good public schools there so that the people whose parents are best equipped to help them after school also get the best education in school, and give the people with the most need for social mobility the worst education. That's our system, right? Who designed that? So you could go on issue after issue. In most rich countries, if you work 29 hours at a retailer, you don't have a different set of health benefits and social insurance than if you work 30. But here, if you work 29 versus 30, that's life or death. There's certain diseases you're going to get that are going to kill you if you work 29 that won't kill you if you work 30.
Right.
And so we have made a bunch of choices in this country to make life nasty, brutish, and short for a lot of people. And we think that the rectification of these problems would lead to gulags because we're ignorant. It's just not true. And one of the things that's actually exciting is if you look at all the people, as you know well, running in this cycle politically, we are actually having a bigger, more capacious conversation about capitalism, socialism, democracy, what is really freedom, than we've had in a long time. And we got all kinds of people running on both sides. We got nationalist Republicans and country club Republicans, and we got democratic socialists, and we have, like, lefty progressives who are not socialists, like Andrew Gillum, and then we got centrist Democrats. And we are actually, to my satisfaction, having a bigger conversation about a set of ideas and what actually assures public welfare in a way that I think is an important beginning.
Well, I mean, you certainly are adding to that conversation with this book, and it was a book that you were able to have supported during your time at the Aspen Institute, which means a lot of the folks who you're criticizing were actually the ones who underwrote, in many ways, the research that you were doing, or at least provided the framework,
the seed of the idea,
the framework of this. And so I appreciate the fact that you've actually had to confront a lot of these individuals who really made it possible for you to develop your concepts and to then promote them and to confront it quite directly, because I think a lot of them, and you could speak to this, of course, consider your ideas radical, socialist, in line with Thomas Piketty's understanding of the economics of the world as capital tends to be a much more important aspect of how we what we value within our societies. And so what are you finding in, because if you are going to try and have an impact with those who are involved in this systemic preservation, what kind of pushback are you getting from those who are, in fact, in that world, who are engaged, who are members of that billionaire class, as you, you know, are in their face?
It's a great question. First of all, I want to say that my real audience for this book is not billionaires who want to be better. It's for everybody else to stop entrusting social change to billionaires. Mm-hmm. Right? My hope for this book is the next time you hear Mark Zuckerberg telling you he's here to save mankind, you understand he's just a guy with a company. Because I actually think if you're able to just see him for what he is, or the people on Wall Street who tell you they're empowering 10,000 women, you know, or J.P. Morgan Chase who caused a financial crisis and now is doing urban revitalization, you know, or David Rubenstein who pushed for the carried interest loophole when he's the Carlyle Group and now calls himself a patriotic philanthropist, helping the government pay for things that he helped defund it and be unable to pay for. If I can change how the public sees those figures, I think it will, I hope it will, induce the public to take change back. And to remember how we actually made real change in this country, which is from below, from movements, from policy, from changing the law.
Yeah.
But to your question about how the people I'm critiquing are taking it, I have to say I have been shocked in a 180-degree way by that. I expected a kind of mountain of opposition and defensiveness and denial. And I think there probably is a lot of that, and I'm not seeing it because those people don't, you know, come to my events in huge numbers. So I can't speak to the absence of that, but I can speak to the presence of an astonishing array of very privileged people, hyper elites, coming forward to me publicly or privately and saying, I think I need to change. I think I need to do better. I thought I was doing something good all these years. I thought my foundation was doing something good. I thought my company was solving these real social problems. But you got me thinking and making me look at my life. And it's not just me, by any means. I want to say something very positive about about a man who's forced a great rethinking in America, and that is Donald J. Trump. I'm serious about this because, you know, there's a lot of research about, like, people's assumptions, right? We are all stuck in our assumptions. Yeah. We all think what we think. We know what we know. It takes an earthquake, a tsunami, a hurricane, illness, divorce, loss, often, to make people really rethink something fundamental in their lives, change their direction. We all know or have experienced this ourselves. Well, Donald Trump is the earthquake, hurricane, tsunami, illness in the life of our nation. Mm-hmm. And I find myself in conversation with a lot of people who say, you know what, I have a bunch of strong beliefs. Trade is good, business is how you solve problems, blah, 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 blah. But if Donald Trump is president, probably a lot of things we all think are wrong. So I'm open. And there is, I am finding in my reporting, an openness to a new conversation and to new assumptions that I don't recognize in my time as a reporter. And so I think we got to make use of that. They say never let a crisis go to waste. Never let an introspective openness among very powerful people go to waste. Many of the most powerful and wealthy people I know are deeply rethinking their place in this society because I think they understand, and it's not only Trump, it's all the people running for office. The country is turning. There's actually a lot of shifts happening at once, and many of them, besides him, are actually positive. They're less attention getting, they don't happen in tweets, but there's a rotation of our culture, I think, towards public life again. There's a, I think, desire to solve problems at the root again. I think there's a retaking of citizenship. And all of that, a lot of that, is inspired by the rock bottom that he helped us hit.
Well, you know, the rethinking and the question of how elites are looking at the book about elites, where you're challenging them, I guess, is in part answered in that Bill Gates is one of your blurbers on the back of your book. So,
and if you can explain that to me, let me know.
He's the top blurb on the back of your book. You know, this question of Trump and the effect that he's creating on our society, I think he proudly sees himself as a disruptor, and I think he has disrupted the thoughts and the assumptions, as you say, that we've all been operating on as a nation, and has reactivated in many ways our society to organize, regardless of where you fall on the spectrum, really regenerated and re-engaged a large part of our society. But you know, when you look at this structure that we are talking about and the challenges to that structure that is self-promoting and self and is acting in the ways that you are suggesting to change. Journalism in many ways is a part of that self-preservation system. I mean, when we talk about this perception that we have of the billionaires and of those who are doing good and doing well at the same time, a lot of the narrative and the myth that is being created within the pages of our former institutions, my current institutions. How do we affect those institutions?
It's a great question. And I, you know, I think one of the, when I was at the very early stages of thinking about the book, I read that Piketty book that many of you bought and maybe didn't read.
It's a heavy book.
And in the early, first or second chapter, there's a passage where he's describing the levels of extreme inequality and the fact that it's going to get worse. But he says, whether or not this level of extreme inequality is sustainable or not depends not only on the repressive apparatus, I don't know exactly what that means, but it sounds tough, but also on the effectiveness of the apparatus of justification. And I just read that phrase, and I underlined it, then I circled it, then I underlined it again, then I underlined it on the side, the apparatus of justification. And it occurred to me that that was the marching orders for my book. His book is not about that. That was an offhand comment. And I said, that's what I got to go do. I got to figure out the apparatus of justification. And I really believe a lot of these extreme inequities and this culture that tasks the people who caused our biggest social problems with fixing them and tasks the people who the winners who took all to kind of help build a more just economy, a lot of that happens in the realm of culture and, as you rightly say, in newspapers. A lot of it happens because of a casual sense that a Mark Zuckerberg is a world changer, because of these Fast Company magazine covers that venerate entrepreneurs instead of asking about their tax strategies, that run stories about Johnny Ive changing Apple instead of running a story about why De Anza Community College, which is right next to Apple, is so starved for funds, even though it's within the shadow of one of the most valuable companies on earth that has $285 billion offshore and where Apple executives send their kids to go swimming, right? It has been a choice in journalism to participate in a kind of, frankly, Trumpy veneration of billionaires, celebration of wealth as tantamount to intelligence, and particularly when people turn to the giving phase, there's definitely some scrutiny of people making their money. But when people turn to the giving phase, there's almost no scrutiny, right? And, you know, the fact, Rob Reich, who's a professor of political science at Stanford, has a great book coming out on philanthropy in a couple of weeks. He says, you know, philanthropy is an exercise of power. And therefore, like any exercise of power, it should inspire skepticism, not gratitude, okay? When people serve in the military, they often do so with noble intentions. We have a military because we want to presumably make the world a better place. Well, that's fine, but none of us should say thank you so much and go home. We got thousands of reporters covering that military. We have multiple congressional committees investigating that military. We have watchdog groups, right? None of that exists for philanthropy. We just assume that because it's noble, it's noble, it's good. Well, philanthropy changes the public conversation. It alters the marketplace of solutions. It has a direct impact on people's lives. It affects what diseases are fought and what are not fought. It's an exertion of power. And when you put your name on buildings, it helps you wipe dirty reputations clean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not sure of how many American publications have a philanthropy correspondent. It was $410 billion last year. That's how much philanthropy was. That's a lot of money to basically not cover. That's just a lot of exertion of influence.
Yeah.
To not cover. And you think we go so hard after like some lobbying firm that takes $5 million, you know, which we should. But like there is stuff happening in philanthropy that as a matter of just the exertion of a few people's influence over public life exists on a scale that makes K Street look trivial. And so I think one of the big things that I actually wanted to do with the book was to not only change how the public thinks about who it outsources change to, but give journalists a new vocabulary for thinking about philanthropy. And I have to say, I'm very happy that this is already happening with or without my book, which is when Bezos gave, made his announcement,
yes.
$2 billion to give to homelessness and education. It was probably the first mega entrant into this big philanthropy thing in some years. And a lot of people have been waiting. This is the biggest fortune in the world. Like, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? There was a kind of anticipation, and I would say, that the general response was different from previous times. It was not just bow down to the Lord. There was some of that, and there was a lot of yeah, but he doesn't pay his workers enough, and yeah, but he doesn't do like that was baked. That wasn't day one coverage.
Right.
I know because I got a lot of those phone calls on day one coverage from reporters on Deadline who don't have a lot of time. That was in their head on day one. That is progress. And a lot of criticism was written in the ensuing 10 days or so. And then he came back and he said, we're raising our wages to $15 an hour because we listened to critics. Now, it turns out they also cut productivity bonuses and stock options. So, you know,
so there's work
he's on a journey, and he's on the early part of the journey. We are not there yet to answer the kid's question. But I think there is something happening where we are starting to learn that when you hear rich man giving money away, you think you show up with questions, not thanks.
So this all begs the question of how do we check this philanthropy? How do we entice these organizations and these individuals to have more civic-minded orientation that is systemic rather than individual, or that happens to be something that is their pet project in certain instances? How do we engage at this moment in time a state that it seems the public doesn't necessarily trust? Organizations and those organizations that are able to both deal with social failure and market failure traditionally, meaning government, at a time when we're seeing that there's also a great deal of distrust of the government and of those who are within the political realm. Are there other structures, institutions, where should we be looking other than, of course, as you suggest, our ability as a society to organize around issues, create movements, but where do we channel that, if you have thought about it, and I'm sure you have.
I think that the government is like your dysfunctional family, okay? You don't eat Thanksgiving alone in a McDonald's because you have a dysfunctional family. You eat it with your dysfunctional family, and you try to make it a little less dysfunctional. And we all get that when it comes to our family, but we bail like chickens when our government is dysfunctional. Yeah, our government is dysfunctional right now. But I want to make a couple points. One, I know a lot of people who use Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and Donald Trump as an alibi for not being civic. Well, it turns out we actually have 90,000 government entities in the United States of America. And as far as I can tell, those guys control 3 out of the 90,000. I know a lot of people who care a lot about criminal justice who have no idea what's going on in their local DA races, local judgeships, right? I know a lot of people who are very excited to be senators who never think of being a county executive. You know this world well. So I think we have to accept the fact that we are in an age in which civic life is in a bad state. We have to also recognize that civic life is in a bad state because the very moneyed interests I'm talking about worked in a concerted way to put it in a bad state, starting in the 1970s to push deregulation, push for tax cuts for rich people, that created a world in which social problems multiplied, government could do less about them, and then philanthropists were the only white knights on the scene to say, well, I can fill the gap.
Right.
You created the gap.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's amazing for Google to say, like, we want to fight for an America in which the news business can flourish better. You killed the news business. You have an abusive monopoly in online advertising. You are deoxygenating any other industry or player that relies on online ads. It is morally and legally indefensible. It is an absolute antitrust issue that simply fails to be one because it's a slightly new legal problem. And then you turn around and say you want to help the future of news? Just stop hurting it.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to change where we go to change the world. No one owes you a highly functional government. If you find your government dysfunctional, go make it more functional. And that doesn't mean just running for office. There's a, you know, I quote this woman at the book, Chiara Cordelli, is a political philosopher at the University of Chicago, and she, you know, she says, you gotta create the conditions, work to create the conditions where we can solve problems publicly again. That means training people to run for office. That means working to get the money out of politics. That means building movements. I always say to people, you're not really in a movement with people if you haven't barbecued with them, right? We have a lot of simulation of citizenship in our time. Our phones make us think we're citizens. We're not actually connected to any of those people. We're liking and poking and sharing and commenting. We're not in a movement with those people. The people in the civil rights movement, the people in the women's suffrage movement, they actually knew each other. They were friends for a really long time. When they took risks, they actually were able to take those risks because they knew each other and trusted each other and had bonds. We don't really have that anymore. We don't have movements. Young people participate in a conversation about things, but don't form durable movements that can scare the hell out of elected officials. I think probably the most astonishing movement of the decade, if not longer, is the Me Too movement. And if you think, if you evaluate that movement from the vantage point of shaping the conversation, changing the conversation, getting justice for some people, changing the way women are able to tell their stories, changing the way men look back on some of their own past. This is an astonishing movement of resounding success. But many people within the movement will tell you that it is a frustration of theirs that they haven't really introduced any legislation anywhere, including in very liberal cities like this one where they might have a real shot at some ordinance, something. It is a hallmark of our age that even the most successful movements often pull up short before implanting their ideas in policy, in law, in the kinds of things that actually solve problems at the root for everybody, instead of remain in the realm of conversation and media and the glare, but that actually go down into the roots, the way the Voting Rights Act did, or any other kind of piece of legislation like that that works at the system. And I think we have to really reclaim that history and that heritage of making those kinds of changes.
Well, and especially since our society actually allows for that. There are plenty of places around the world where that type of organization and ability to engage in the civic movement, action, can land you in jail or worse. And so when the opportunity is there, it certainly feels as if it's incumbent on all of us to make that move.
We've been hearing from Anand Girdatis. He's in conversation with Marcus Kounoulakis. Anand is the author of a new book entitled Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. After the break, we'll hear about alternate ways of advancing many philanthropic causes. Thank you. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from Anand Giridharadas. He is the author of a new book entitled Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He's in conversation with my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts from our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our conversation.
This is the part of the program where I pull the questions. And in fact, we have Monica, who lives in Oakland, California, and she's asking why American culture is so resistant to seeing problems not through a structural lens, but rather as a dearth of individual will and effort. And what will it take to change this?
It's a great question. You know, I've been reading this amazing book, new book that you all should read called These Truths by Jill Lepore. It's this new sweeping history of the United States from 1492 to present. First survey of that kind written by a woman. It's an extraordinary book. And her interpretation of the Founding Fathers is very interesting, and I think gets to this question, which is she's not the first person, but she really frames the Founding Fathers as people who are overreacting. Like, she kind of goes through, like, the Stamp Act and the whole tea thing. Like, they were actually, like, the tea thing was just formalizing something that was already true. The Stamp Act was, like, pretty minor. And all the other colonies of Jamaica, like, they're all fine with it. Like, we were founded by, I always think, like, we were founded by, like, a nation of, like, Ai Weiwei's, right? Like kind of these, like, renegade people who took, like, relatively small oppressions when they were actually visiting much graver oppressions on the slaves in their midst. They were so exercised about, like, having to put stamps on paper and having a tea tax that was already in effect, that they wrote this, like, extraordinary document when in the course of human... And in this book, when you actually read the declaration relative to the stuff that the British were doing to them, it's almost comical,
yeah.
Right? And it's an amazing document, but, like, they weren't being hurt, like, that badly. and I think that's important to answer this question, because I think in that heritage and the language of the country, there is this, like, extreme dissident, isolated sensibility of the heretic. And we just have we don't have as much of a collective vocabulary. I think we imagine ourselves, like, as this nation of dissidents in that founding language. And I think that's just carried through the present, and we don't have a vocabulary. So one, like, very simple example is we are very sensitive in this country to unfreedom that comes from concentrated government power. We're basically still fleeing the king. That's my point. We are hypersensitive to the king. King George is, like, in all of our minds, right? And so anything in this country today that derives from an unfreedom, like, that's, like, King George getting you, the government coming to get your guns, that's, like, King George coming to get your guns. Or, like, the government charging you tax, that's King George levying a tax. We're hypersensitive, hyper-aware, vigilant, sometimes to a benefit, sometimes not. What we are much less able to appreciate is threats to our freedom that don't kind of come with the embodiment of a king. Threats to our freedom that come from sometimes the absence of authority, right? So we're much more sensitive to the government taking our guns than we are to thousands of gun deaths because of the chaos of having too many guns out there. We're much less able to protect ourselves from the chaos of a housing crisis that costs millions of people their homes than we are so ready and willing to fight, like, one banking regulation. We recognize tyranny when it comes in the shape of King George, and we are totally blind to the tyranny of collective systems, which is a long way of saying I just think we need to, frankly, like, redo our imagination, America, because a lot of threats to people's freedom don't come in the shape that we as Americans have been trained primordially to expect it. And that's the end of my King George.
Okay, theory. Well, I was going to say, you know, maybe we should rename Yahoo
you should
to
all
King
read that
George.
And, yes. I'll read These Truths by Jill Lepore. It's unbelievable. So and invite her here.
Okay. Whoever it is that's in charge of the programming should invite her. Here's a question from Susan Lucas, and she asks, are any of the billionaire philanthropists focusing on, quote, economic inequality and persistent poverty in the U.S. multi-generationally? In other words, are the folks that you're being critical of actually doing something to raise taxes, support the common good, strengthen civic life, and actually undermine their ability to make a profit?
I think there's some examples. You know, for example, if you look at the people who fund ProPublica, mm-hmm. I mean, there's some small dollar people, but there's also some bigger people. That is not the kind of, that's not like the self-dealing kind of giving that I'm critiquing. That's a very little benefit to a rich person, right? The best that can happen you go to ProPublica is that they're not going to touch anybody you know. The worst that can happen is they're going to investigate everybody you know if you're a very rich person. And that's the kind of giving that makes the system better, that holds people to account, the benefits of which flow into civic life. You know, there are people out here in California who have done philanthropic work trying to improve the quality of the census count, mm-hmm. right? There's this mechanism where private people can suggest to the government addresses that the government is unlikely to count properly. Someone living on a mattress on a roof, the government's not going to have that listed. But if you tell them that there's someone living on that roof on a mattress, then they will add it to a database and they'll count it. Right? So there's folks who fund clipboard walk-arounds, which are very labor-intensive, to do that. That's, again, you're not doing that to benefit yourself as a rich person. You're not putting your name on a library. You're doing that because you actually want to enhance the count. And by the way, if we count more poor and vulnerable people, that's going to hurt you on balance, right? That's more of your tax dollars going to more people.
But you would argue that it would help you overall because you're strengthening your democratic system, isn't
yes.
that right?
It may not help you in a narrow sense. Actually try to stay away from these like win-win, like, but it's still good for you in the long run. It may not be good for you. It's still the right thing to do.
Yes, but are you arguing, in fact, that that the health of our society and the health of our democracy
yes.
actually relies on not... cutting out. Yeah, okay.
The health overall.
I'm not talking about
but
the
win-win. But sometimes that means Lord and Lady Grantham don't get to live in a castle
yes.
anymore. You know?
Yes.
And that's better for the society,
yes.
but it's not better for Lord and Lady Grantham.
That's
But it's still maybe the right thing for them to push. And so then when you look at someone like...
Although they may not be strung up in the end. I mean, that also is probably good for Lord and Lady Grantham.
Faster you move, right?
Yeah.
But let's turn it around to... Take someone like Bezos, how could he shift from the bad side of this to the good side of this? So he announced, he's very early in this,
yeah.
$2 billion, $1 billion for homelessness, $1 billion for education. The preschool is going to be focused on the customer like Amazon. So I guess you can return your education within 2 weeks or less or something. and it comes
sooner if it's prime.
Huge unnecessary boxing with
yeah.
those puffy plastic things.
Yeah.
So... A lot of what he announced, it's fine, but it's symptom treatment, right? It's not dealing with the root causes of poverty or inequality. It's helping some poor kids who don't get good educations, helping some homeless families in Seattle. Fine, nothing objectionable. People will be helped. But how could he get to a place of the kind of giving you're talking about? Dealing with civic life, solving things at the root. So first of all, when you employ people the way they do at Amazon, you contribute to homelessness and inequality and poverty, you know. So the first thing I often say to these folks is, first, don't ask what you can do for your country. Ask what you've done to your country, mm-hmm. okay? And first, stop doing the things that you've done that are, let's stop the bleeding first, right? Because if you're helping over here, but you're still bloodletting, it's not that helpful. So stop what you're doing. And then if you were to ask, okay, well, what could I do? How could I give more transformatively? Let's take one issue. He made his money because of a glitch in history, which is that the labor union movement was very weak as the internet was rising. If unions had been where they were 30 years ago when Amazon started, it wouldn't be what it was. He wouldn't be worth $160 billion. And I'm not saying he created that reality because he didn't create that reality. He made use of that reality. But that was just a historical fact. And probably in 20, 30 years, we will have figured out new ways to protect workers. That's my bet. But in the period that he happened to make $160 billion, it's hard to think about that fortune having been made if workers had had more bargaining power. The model is built on how little bargaining power workers happened to have in that period. Okay, so you say, okay, I want to give in a transformative way. I got $160 billion with a B to play with. Imagine if he said, okay, I can't change what I did. I have some regrets about it. I'm willing to defend it in other ways. But I want to invest billions of dollars in the future of worker power in this country. Right? I want to help people figure out what are the unions of the future. I want to strengthen labor protections. I want to improve fight for legislation that would actually make it easier for workers to be safe on the job, have some bargaining power, have benefits. And I understand that if I succeed over here in this philanthropic work, it's going to raise the cost of doing business for Amazon. It actually may hurt Amazon. Remember, a lot of his wealth is still stock. My $160 billion may go down more from the devaluation of my stock than from giving money away. But that, I think, would be real giving.
Yeah.
It would be, as a New York Times writer, we did a piece where he wrote about my book and what it would mean for Bezos. And the way Farhad Manjoo summarized it was, Jeff Bezos should give in a way that makes sure there's never another Jeff Bezos.
Right. And Anand, this is, you know, we're in this global reality, right? So let's assume, or let's hope, that maybe Jeff Bezos takes the bait, sees the light, moves in this direction, and somebody in Beijing at Tencent or Alibaba says, ha, there's an opening. I don't have labor laws that are going to require me to do these types of things. I can quickly fill in that very vacuum in a non-democratic society where there are no labor laws and take advantage of the globalized weakness of a system that protects individuals and, in their case, doesn't protect the citizens of its own society.
Well, we should write better trade laws.
Okay. So
and that's what trade laws are for. And again, I mean, like a lot of things Donald Trump says, you know, there's like a 5% truth in it, but and then the remaining 95% is less true than anybody who's ever used the English language. Even people who haven't used it well the way he can't. And, you know, but there's actually a kernel of truth that was ignored by people in both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
The trade was not working for many people. And the Chinese, for example, are much better than us at like looking at their society and getting what they want from trade arrangements than we are. My favorite example of this is the Chinese made this deal where basically if you want to be a foreign company operating in China, you have to work with a local partner. What's a kind of weird requirement? Well, it's actually a kind of genius requirement. You know why? You cause every company in the world to create a mentorship program for your entire like executive core, and you force the world's companies that they want to come to your country to train like 200,000 executives over a period of years,
yeah.
Right? That's brilliant. That's not free trade. That's smart trade.
Yeah.
And we could be much more creative in actually saying, hey, if you exploit your workers, you don't get access to this market. All of this is policy. This is what I mean by changing things at the root for everybody.
But in the same way, and I'm going to just follow up on this, but in the same way that you're suggesting that American billionaires and corporations have essentially captured the state, haven't we now, because of these weaknesses, these market failures, these social failures, haven't we arrived at a point where, in fact, other countries, too, have been able, and other corporations that are global, captured the state to prevent the types of policies that maybe Donald Trump is promoting, but in practical, actual fact, are going to be very difficult to get imposed. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't try, but it
seems
that
that's actually another great place for philanthropic efforts. What it's going to, I mean, Citizens United has to be one of the great priorities for anybody who loves this country, getting rid of it. And that's not going to be easy. That's a project of building movements. But that's an issue, by the way, where if you sell it right, there's a lot of people on the right, average people, who do not like the idea of companies running Washington.
Right.
Right? That's an area where the right's actually divided against itself.
Well, speaking of big companies, Joel, who works at Google,
hi, Joel.
Silicon, hey, wherever he is, I'm not going to point him out.
He's everywhere.
He has a very simple question. This is relevant because you were recently at Google speaking, and he asks, what would you like to see Google do? What would you do if you worked there?
So I went to Google in early September. They asked me to give a talk in Boston, Google Boston. I never know if people invite me because they haven't read my book or because if they have. It's always confusing. And I was just going to talk about my book in generic terms, and about 45 minutes out of Boston on the train, I realized, well, that's kind of stupid. I should talk about the specifics of Google at Google. So I had 45 minutes left, so I made some notes, and basically gave a talk about a lot of what we're talking about today, but in the context of the story that prevails at Google. I have one of the characters in my book was a important founding member at Google, and I spent a lot of time with him. And he talks about this idea that I think is so endemic in Silicon Valley in general, which is we feel like whatever is good for our company is what's best for the world. And we feel so lucky that we have alighted. I love you. we feel so lucky that we've alighted on a set of tools that simply building and developing them and jamming them out into the world will liberate humanity. So the faster we can do that, the less encumbered we can be in doing that, the less questions journalists can ask, the less regulated we are, the better for humanity. Now, when you take something like Google Search, there's a certain truth to the fact that what has made them a lot of money has definitely been good for the world. We all probably did 100 searches today, right? If you're a doctor in Malawi dealing with a complicated case, the world is a lot better for you in a world in which Google has built this than not. On the other hand, they've gotten so hooked on the story. What I said in the talk is they have become unable to see all the places where the story breaks down. All the places where what's good for them and what's good for the world happen to be different. And that's not a horrible thing. That's just true of, you know, if you're a shoe manufacturer, there are some ways in which making shoes is good for the world and fills a need. But, you know, but if you make them out of some, you know, chemical that pollutes all the rivers, there's like some places where that may not be good for the world. And you got to deal with that. And that's why we have a government. And I suggested to them that their maturity would require them to accept that they are now power. They're not rebels against power anymore. They're not hackers. They've actually made it. Their revolution succeeded, and they're behaving like little babies who don't want to be regulated because they still think they're fighting the power, but they are the power. And that there's nothing more dangerous than a Goliath who thinks they're a David. So that went over well. And, I mean, you should see, it was not a packed room, by the way. It was like not a popular talk, like 10 people showed up. And then those 10 people were like, the whole time. It's like, have you ever seen an engineer who thinks they're about to die? It was like, it was nervous making. And then they basically stalled on putting the talk online. They were like, we're definitely going to put it online. Like a month goes by. No talk on YouTube. So my publisher's like, we've never seen this before. Yeah. We deal with them all the time. Never seen this before. We contact them. Ah, you know, I'm not associated with that project anymore. Right?
Right.
That's like always a sign something's going wrong. So I did what I do best, which is leak it to a publication. people do it to me, I do it to them. So we trade little favors. So I called a great tech reporter, and I was like, this is happening. I think it's a good story. And it turns out this woman has like a special expertise in the Google Authors Talk program for a different issue, which has to do with conservatives and liberals, but she knew a lot about that program. And she's like, yeah, that is weird. So she starts making calls. A couple hours later, like, yeah, we're putting it online very soon, you know. And it would have been a better story if it was actually censored, but I kind of screwed it up by having her call. and so they put it online.
Yeah.
But it gets to the question of, I think the biggest thing these companies need to do is stop doing the harm they do. Google is a monopoly that needs to be broken up. We could call it Goo and Gull.
Alpha and Bet.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that monopoly has consequences. Just because monopoly is a boring issue does not mean it's not important. That monopoly has basically killed the media business. There are many states in this country that don't have a media outlet monitoring the state legislature, writing about what bills are passed, what happens in committee. I mean, that is how you lose a country. That is how you get a Russia, where basically the leaders can do whatever. You know, we're closer to that than we realize, not because of some grand design, but because we're just like, the First Amendment's just not being exercised in a bunch of parts of this country because no one can keep a newspaper open. And Google is doing that along with Facebook. And so stop doing the harm. Don't try to do big things. Just stop first. Stop doing harm. And look at your own complicity and not just your ability to like solve all these big big problems. First, stop doing harm and get out of the way of the public when it wants to solve its problems acting as a public, and accept that there may be things the public needs to do for its welfare that conflict with your interests, and that part of being a grown-up as a company is understanding that what is good for you is not always what is good for society, and being like an adult about it.
Yuki Ueda, who asks, in your book, you should shine a light, you shine a light on fake change workers as sellouts who are willing to accept Band-Aids for social problems. But change is slow and comes from many directions. Her real question is how, you know, what we're looking for are some big changes here, whether they be questions of antitrust or issues of monopoly. How do we get civic engagement, grow an understanding of the common good? But that these things happen very slowly in societies such as ours, especially a democratic society such as ours, where we have a lot of stakeholders. How do we get there?
What do we do in the meantime as we're moving in that direction?
As you are, you know, inciting us to get up out of our seats and leave our jobs and, you know, at least change the organizations where we currently work.
I'll give you a simple example of how to make that shift, because I think it's a very important issue. The kind of change I'm calling for is tough and takes time and involves building movements and building political power and all of those things. And there is need right now. There are those homeless people in the streets of San Francisco right now. There are people disrupted by globalization and automation right now. And none of what I'm suggesting is that we should ignore that in favor of the big changes. But even in how we approach the immediate need, there are ways of approaching it that serve solely as Band-Aids, and there's ways of approaching it that help push us in the direction of that kind of deeper change. And I think a lot of people who are doing important giving right now, no one is suggesting that they should cease and desist. The idea is, how do you take what you're doing and make sure that ultimately it is not in any way shoring up a bad system by reputation laundering for bad people, et cetera, et cetera, and that it's actually starting to push in the direction of solving the problem, not just for the people you're helping right now, but at the root for everybody through institutions, solutions that are public, institutional, democratic, and universal. And I think that one example could be applied to any number of other examples where genuinely good works that are all around us in our time could be made so much richer.
Join me in thanking Anand for this evening.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured a conversation with Anand Giridharadas. He's the author of the new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. The conversation was with my co-host, Marcus Kunalakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.